Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Sichon Siv, former American ambassador to the United Nations, and hear about his story about escaping from the Khmer Rouge. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Paul Berkowitz. He's author of the book, The Case of the Indian Trader, Billy Malone and the National Park Service Investigation at the Hubble Trading Post. And he will be speaking tonight, Wednesday, August 24th at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
That's very good to be here. Thank you.
So your book recounts the story of Billy Malone, the longtime Indian trader at the Hubble Trading Post, which is in Arizona in Navajo country. Tell us about this trading post and trading posts in general, what it meant historically to be an Indian trader.
Well, that's one of the key things, actually, to the story, is the fact that it's widely, I think, misunderstood what an Indian trading post really is. Hubble Trading Post was set aside, well, actually was established in the 1880s. It's one of the oldest trading posts in the West by a man named John Lorenzo Hubble, who grew up in the region, started his own trading post in the Ganado area of the Navajo Reservation, and it has been in continuous operation ever since the late 1880s. And in the 1960s, as a part of an effort to preserve the trading post itself and the history of Indian trading in the West, the Hubble family approached the National Park Service to see if they would purchase it. And through a series of maneuvers and political efforts, in the early 1960s, that came to fruition. The National Park Service was authorized by Congress to buy Hubble Trading Post. But one of the key distinctions that occurred was that the Park Service committed to actually keep Hubble Trading Post operating as a real living trading post and not as a historic museum. So that meant that they were obligated to employ legitimate Indian traders from the region to continue the operation. And so that's really the significance of Hubble Trading Post itself. And Billy Malone, by most accounts, is the last of those legitimate Indian traders.
Now tell us more about Billy Malone. He ran the Hubble Trading Post for many years. He was married to a Navajo. He spoke Navajo, raised Navajo children on the reservation. He was really not your what you would call a typical sort of corporate businessman by any means.
No, not a corporate businessman, but that's what made him a real Indian trader. Billy was raised in the Gallup area, and which is largely Indian country, and had relatives in the trading business, his stepfather. And at a very early age, right after he got out of the Army, began as an apprentice Indian trader in Lupton, Arizona. And that was in, I think, 1960. And all the way from 1960 up until 2004, Billy worked as an Indian trader on the Navajo Reservation and really came to be known and to gain a reputation as one of the most trusted and really kind of kind and generous traders in the region. He is quite literally an icon, I think, on the Navajo Reservation and in the Indian trading community, just for his relationship with the Navajos. Again, I think you're right, in the 60s, he met Minnie Goodluck, who was a Navajo gal from the area, I think around Lupton or Fort Defiance. They married, raised children, raised them as Navajos on the reservation, going to Bureau of Indian Affairs schools, and really just became totally immersed in that community. And one of the key things, of course, about a trading post is that it's not an arts and crafts store like we tend to think of them in the Santa Fe region, but the real trading posts on the reservations were more on the order of kind of a general store, hardware store, post office, just kind of a one place meets every conceivable community need that you can think of. And that's the role that Billy played in the community at every one of those places that he worked.
Now, this book talks about the conflict between the National Park Service, who ended up investigating Billy Malone, and the whole world that Billy Malone was living in. Talk for a moment about the culture of the National Park Service. I mean, most of us think of this service as one of the more benign and really genuinely useful branches of government.
Well, Park Service, of course, has many components, and operates many different kinds of sites. National parks like Yellowstone, Yosemite, you know, for their natural and natural scenery, their wildlife, and then a number of historic sites, of which Hubble Training Post became one in the 60s. So they have responsibility. In essence, the overriding responsibility is to preserve these areas in the condition in which they were originated. For natural area, to maintain the natural scenery. If it's a historic site, to maintain the historic integrity of those sites. The Park Service is overall, you know, has a wonderful mission. It has largely wonderful people. But it also has just this incredible public image that I argue in the book has in some respects insulated them from legitimate scrutiny and therefore the need to self-correct occasionally. And, of course, like any organization, like any government agency, they're subject to political pressure and political influence. You have good and bad people in the organization. And I think in the case of Hubble Trading Post, when allegations were raised that there was something wrong going on at Hubble, the entity that brought those allegations, Western National Parks Association, was such a politically powerful organization that from the very beginning there was a failure to scrutinize the allegations and to do the basic homework that might otherwise have occurred if a reporting party had not been that politically powerful. I think that's probably the place where this story really got off on the wrong footing.
Why did the Western National Parks Association and the National Park Service go after Billy Malone in the first place? What did they suspect? What did they accuse him of?
Well, let me back up a minute. We mentioned that the Park Service bought Hubble Trading Post in the 60s through authorization of Congress. There was legislation passed. The Park Service itself was not in a position to run a commercial enterprise, which, of course, a trading post is. And after a series of kind of exploratory efforts, they seized upon the idea of getting what was then known as the Southwest Parks and Monuments Association. It's a nonprofit cooperating association that works in conjunction with the National Park Service to sell books and educational materials. That's their typical role. They approached SPMA, Southwest Parks and Monuments Association, to see if they would act as a surrogate for the National Park Service to actually employ the Indian traders that the Park Service had committed to have run Hubble Trading Post. Southwest Parks and Monuments Association in the early 2000s evolved into the Western National Parks Association. They run bookshops and sell items in national parks across the West, I think something like 60 to 65 different locations. They're one of the largest nonprofit cooperating associations, and they donate literally millions of dollars to the Park Service. The revenues contribute largely to educational efforts and to support activities of the Park Service through nonprofit tax deductible donations. So WNPA employed the traders at Hubble Trading Post, including Billy Malone, who was brought to Hubble in, I think, 1981. The thing that kind of kicked things off, in my judgment, is they had a change in management at WNPA, at their corporate offices in Tucson, in, I think, 2003. And that meant they had a new executive director, they had a new board chairman, and I think some brand new board members as well. And regrettably, there was not any form of meaningful transition that occurred between the old management at WNPA and the new management. So that when the new managers came in, they really didn't have much of an idea about what Hubble Trading Post was, what it was supposed to be, how it had been run historically, which, again, is not, I use a phrase, it's not business 101. It's shirt pocket accountability, handshakes, notes on a scribbled on a piece of paper, and dealing largely with a very traditional Navajo clientele. Many of the patrons there don't read, write, or speak English. They're still strictly Navajo speaking. So it's a very, very different world. And I think at the very beginning, the new management at WNPA didn't really understand that. and didn't understand that that is the mode in which Billy Malone had operated for his entire career. So when they saw some of the ways that he did business, when they saw some of the record keeping that, indisputably didn't meet contemporary standards, but it wasn't supposed to, they became very alarmed. At the same time, apparently, WNPA was mired in its own corporate-level accounting problems and really didn't have a sense of what their operating revenues were, what their costs were. And at some point after the transition in management, it was uncovered that they were in pretty serious financial trouble. So between their financial troubles, their lack of understanding of what was going on at Hubble Trading Post, for some reason or another, they fixated on Hubble Trading Post as the source of their financial woes, which it turns out was not the case. And Billy Malone, therefore, one thing leading to another, by their reasoning, Billy must be responsible for the financial troubles. And therefore, they concluded that he was embezzling money on the order of, quote, millions and millions of dollars.
It's such a story of a culture clash. I mean, as you say, you know, business 101 on the one hand and Billy Malone's way of doing things on the other hand. He was generous to a fault when he was at Hubble. He took care of so many people on the Navajo Reservation. He sealed deals with a handshake. People signed their name with a thumbprint. There was no dividing line between his personal life and his life was being an Indian trader, and everything he did was being an Indian trader. And so he had some of his stuff among the Trading Post's items. The new executive director of the Western National Parks Association comes in, is horrified that some of his own things are there, and throws them in the dumpster. I mean, that seemed to me so emblematic of the larger problem, which is such incredibly different ways of seeing the world.
Oh, absolutely. It's a total clash of cultures on many, many levels. And Billy in particular, he was absolutely immersed in this lifestyle. When he was home at night, patrons would come to his home and conduct business. I mean, Billy was an Indian trader 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for the majority of his life. He lived and breathed it. And again, you know, very loyal to his customers, and his customers in turn were very, very loyal to him. And frankly, that's what makes him such a unique figure. He's probably one of the last people to have that kind of an intimate day-in, day-out relationship with the Navajo community. One of the things that came out in some historic interviews that I read that Billy had actually engaged in with some university people was that, I mean, he was so immersed in the community that he helped officiate at funerals and weddings, performed all kind of community services well beyond those of a merchant. I mean, he was really a very central figure in the community. And that, you know, that didn't really separate from the business side of it. It was one whole package that would probably be baffling to somebody who didn't live in that community and see how it operated. But absolutely, this clash of cultures figured in a significant way in where things went wrong. And people from the outside looking in, not understanding in the slightest what they were seeing.
So Billy Malone's house was raided. They confiscated his entire life savings, which was his personal collection of Navajo rugs and jewelry. They fired him from his job. They kicked him out of his house, which came with the job. And tell us exactly what they suspected him of having done and what their evidence was.
Well, when the management at WNPA approached the Park Service with their suspicions, again, this kind of mismatch of, oh, we've got financial troubles, we don't understand what's going on at Hubble, therefore Hubble must be the source of the problem, and Billy Malone, therefore, the culprit. The allegation was that Billy was embezzling, quote-unquote, again, millions and millions of dollars through some elaborate scheme that admittedly they didn't understand, but that they drew a very premature conclusion. Went to the National Park Service with those suspicions, and the Park Service just bent over backwards, again, not questioning the allegations, not corroborating any of the information, not even corroborating whether or not there were genuinely any funds missing from WNPA. But based upon that, the investigators in the case originally got a federal search warrant to go into Billy's home and seize any records and other documents that might provide evidence of an embezzlement scheme. When they went into his home, I think it was June the 9th, 2004, they didn't frankly find that many records. Not surprisingly, because Billy didn't keep that many records. He wasn't a paper kind of guy. That's not how old-time Indian trading worked. But what they did find was a house full of old Indian rugs and jewelry and other arts and crafts. And immediately walking into his home, they concluded nobody could have this much stuff. Nobody could have this many rugs, this many pieces of jewelry. And therefore, we already suspect of embezzlement. Now we're concluding that all this stuff must be stolen. And based upon that assumption, they seized the majority of that property as suspected stolen property, even though those items were not authorized for seizure under the search warrant. So they really overreached the scope of the search warrant. And once again, they didn't understand what was going on. Billy Malone, for the majority of his life, didn't even have a bank account. His life savings, as you say, were in rugs and jewelry and other types of arts and crafts. So when they seized that property, what they did, in effect, was to seize his life savings.
Right. Now, after that, there were 2 years of what you describe in the book and in quite a lot of detail as basically a poor, lackadaisical investigation. A lot of taxpayer money was spent. Nothing happened. No real substantive investigating happened. They didn't even interview a lot of the important people in this investigation. And then you, a special agent for the National Park Service, were brought in to close the case and ostensibly to arrest Billy Malone. What happened next when you came in?
Well, when I came in, obviously, the case had been going on its own for about a year and a half. Park Service investigation was launched in May of 2004. I was brought in essence, December 2006, January 2007. So it had been going on for about a year and a half. The Park Service had spent something close to $1 million trying to make a case on Billy. They had never interviewed Billy. They had never interviewed any of his former supervisors prior to this new management team. So they never did get a grasp for how things had worked. And they never still even scrutinized the claims of lost revenues from WNPA. And so there was a great deal of frustration. A lot of money was being spent. A lot of time had been expended, a lot of personnel resources. And so the Washington, D.C. offices were getting frustrated with this. And through a series of bizarre maneuvers, I was approached. I was already working Indian country crime on the Navajo Reservation, based in Chinle, and was asked basically if I'd be willing to take over the case. And a couple of the criteria were to try to figure out some way to arrest Billy Malone for something and do it fairly quickly and without spending a lot of money. And some of the things that I heard when I was approached with it were pretty disturbing, along the lines of, we don't really care what you charge him with, find something to charge him with. In effect, justify the time and expense that's already gone into this case. Didn't make overt comments to my supervisors at that time, but I did share that information with the U.S. Attorney's Office very shortly after I agreed to accept the case. And once I began the case, I just started looking through the old case files, looking at the affidavit for the search warrant, reading old reports, talking to some of the investigators who'd been involved. And then what I did that nobody else had done was I actually reached out to some of Billy's former supervisors, as well as some of Billy's friends, and ultimately reached out to Billy to see if he'd come in for an interview. And that was really when things took a different direction.
You became convinced that he hadn't stolen or embezzled anything, and in fact that he was an honorable man who'd been treated very poorly by the folks who were investigating him. And you saw to it that his property was returned. That created quite a lot of political fallout. What happened then?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that, even, because as expenses were running up in the investigation, the Park Service made the dubious move of approaching Western National Parks Association to see if they would actually help fund the investigation against Billy Malone. And they reached an agreement where WNPA actually ponied up several thousands of dollars. They agreed to commit $75,000 to help pay for this investigation against their former employee, against the person that they had accused of embezzlement. And as a part of those negotiations to pay for the case, according to different accounts, but it comes clear that there was an understanding reached that one of the benefits that WNPA would reap was that they would probably get all of his property that had been taken from Billy Malone. And that account came out after I made the decision to return the property to Billy. You're right. I mean, I looked at this case and in consultation with the U.S. Attorney's Office concluded that, among other things, there was no evidence that money had ever been stolen. It looked like it was mostly accounting errors at the corporate headquarters of WNPA in Tucson. We brought Billy in for an interview and actually had him submit polygraph examination by the FBI. And we concluded that his account of everything was totally accurate, which included that he'd never stolen anything, that the rugs, jewelry, and other property that had been seized was either his or in his lawful care as something that belonged to either his family, his wife, or other relatives and friends. So, in effect, there was no substantial evidence that a crime had ever occurred. And when I made the decision to return the property to Billy, and when my supervisors and the folks at WNPA found out that I had done that, it created quite a firestorm. And I became subjected to a lot of scrutiny, a lot of criticism. What was I doing? And at that point in time is when the folks at WNPA acknowledged that they had expected that they were going to get all this property back. They thought they had made a deal with the Park Service, that if they helped fund the investigation, that they would be, quote-unquote, partners in the investigation. This property was supposed to go to them, not to Billy. And really just kind of in a panic attack mode, that's when a lot of these other incidental deals came to surface, that came to light. And it was at that point in time that I had to make some pretty serious decisions.
I mean, there's so much corruption and just poor handling of this case that you describe in the book. I mean, first of all, the Western National Parks Association was the only one in this whole story who seems to have done poor accounting, whereas Billy Malone, with his kind of freewheeling shirt pocket accounting, hadn't done anything wrong at all, and yet he was the one who was being scapegoated. And then these two organizations were making a deal with each other that was completely beyond their legal purview as agencies, and you know, their agreement was basically to fund things like educational programs and not criminal investigations. And then basically this whole bureaucratic cover your butt mentality takes over.
Yeah, I mean it you know, it started off arguably just as raw incompetence and gross negligence. I mean, at minimum, making allegations without really knowing if they were true, receiving allegations without doing the slightest bit of investigation to see if there was any substance to the allegations. And then it gets worse from there, from just raw incompetence and negligence to kind of greed. Everybody's eyes get really big when they see the stuff that Billy has, which they massively overvalued in terms of their estimates of it. A lot of the stuff Billy had was 50 or 60 years old, and therefore arguably valuable because of its age. But a lot of it also was just, you know, children's weavings and things that he had bought almost out of charity to help keep families going on the reservation or to encourage young weavers. But still, so they see all this stuff, they think, oh my gosh, you know, we've hit the lottery. And all of this stuff is going to make us rich, and it's also going to make the investigators in this case, you know, heroes for making the big case. And then from there, once I step into the case and uncover all the impropriety and the misconduct, then you're right, it turns into a cover-your-butt kind of situation, where now it's cover-up, keep this stuff secret, we don't want it to get out, and how dare you basically switch sides. You're supposed to be against this guy, and it was perceived as though I had turned on my own people. Because what I also found was that exculpatory information that had surfaced that actually could have shed light on the allegations had been omitted from the report. So things got worse and worse and worse. And again, kind of incompetence to greed to cover up, and it just deteriorated.
You ended up submitting your report rather than to your superiors at the National Park Service, to the Office of the Inspector General, basically taking a kind of whistleblower position. Your claims in your report, and the summary of which you've just told us on this program today, were all corroborated at thereafter.
Yes. My supervisors didn't even realize that I'd finished my investigation. Too many of my own supervisors' names were in my report, where I had documented these deals that had been made with WNPA, withholding exculpatory information, other things that were just totally improper. So I turned my report into the U.S. Attorney's Office and simultaneously sent a copy to the Office of the Inspector General, and they were awaiting my report. They knew ahead of time. I'd been in contact with them about my concerns. Subsequently, the Inspector General, the IG, undertook their own internal investigation into the conduct of National Park Service investigators and senior managers, as well as the officials from WNPA. And their investigation, in effect, was launched in roughly January 2007 and was completed January 2008. And in that interim period, shortly after I finished my report, I submitted my retirement notice papers because I simply didn't want to be a part of that organization, and I didn't want to be hamstrung and restricted in my ability to speak freely. So I retired while the IG was conducting their investigation. Their investigation concluded January 2008, and as those reports have been made public through a series of lawsuits, everything that I've maintained in the book and that I maintain in my report has been fully corroborated.
Now that this is out in public and you've written the book and there's been publicity about it, do you see the National Park Service or the Western National Parks Association learning from their mistakes, making any changes of any kind?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. Right now, Billy has filed a lawsuit, and that's ongoing, so there's a lot of tight lips. But, you know, unfortunately, it seems that the only thing that kind of motivates change and reform is when things like this are exposed publicly. One of the real incentives for writing the book was to shed light on this type of thing, and also to shed light on the conditions in the Park Service, how it operates, how it maintains relationships with organizations like WNPA that really allowed something like this to happen, because Billy's case is not the first case of this type that has occurred over the decades. It's just a very contemporary and very compelling case that I saw as useful to make the bigger case that there's some systemic problems that really need to be addressed in terms of integrity, honesty, self-scrutiny in the Park Service, and particularly its law enforcement program. So that's one of the principal objectives of the book, along with just, in effect, helping Billy to redeem his reputation. He was so wrongly, he was maligned, he was wrongly accused, and the book serves two purposes. I think it's done the one where I think where Billy's reputation has very much been restored. Whether or not we're successful in bringing sufficient light to some of the problems in the National Park Service and bringing reform to how it operates is yet to be seen. That is my hope. But again, everybody's kind of tight-lipped. They're saying, well, we can't discuss it, or we consider it a closed matter. All these kinds of public statements coming out of the Public Affairs Office that are not particularly hopeful, but what I do hope is that the momentum continues for the book and that really, in some way, they'll be compelled to address these larger issues, because this sort of thing shouldn't happen. It was predictable. It would happen. It will happen again unless some changes occur.
What happened to Billy Malone?
Well, Billy, of course, was devastated. His life was turned upside down, and by many accounts, he nearly died after this incident. He suffered a series of very, very serious health issues. He was actually hospitalized for 3 months. He was on life support for a period. I'm sure that stress was a major contributor to all of that. But he kind of went on. He had some very supportive members of the community who gave him jobs in other stores. And at this point in time, very recently, he's opened up his own Bill Malone Trading Company in Gallup, New Mexico. And I think that's only been open for a few weeks, but by all accounts is doing quite well. But I think ultimately I know that Billy would, you know, he loved Hubble Trading Post, and he would love to go back to Hubble. That was his life. And in many respects, Billy Malone's name is synonymous now with Hubble Trading Post. That's where he should be. And ideally, they would find some way to bring him back, not only to offer an apology to Bill, but also to allow Hubble Trading Post to restore its reputation in the community. Because one of the really long-term problems that came out of this is that Hubble Trading Post, when Billy Malone was fired, quit being that legitimate trading post that Congress had mandated it be. And since then, most of Billy's clientele followed Billy where he went to these other jobs. And by most accounts, Hubble Trading Post now is more of a curio shop and that kind of dead, embalmed historic site museum rather than a living trading post that it's supposed to be. And in my judgment, the only way they'll be able to restore that is if in some way, shape, or form they bring Billy back to mentor somebody. But the community, I don't think, is going to accept Hubble Trading Post until Billy Malone is a part of it.
Paul Berkowitz is author of the book The Case of the Indian Trader, Billy Malone and the National Park Service Investigation at the Hubble Trading Post, and he will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much. It's been an honor.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Sichan Siv. He is former United States Ambassador to the United Nations. His memoir is called Golden Bones, and he will be in Santa Fe this Saturday, August 27th at 5 in the afternoon at the Travel Bug Bookstore. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So you had a beautiful and peaceful childhood in Cambodia, though you lost your father at an early age. Tell us about your early experience in Cambodia in the 1950s and 60s when you were a small child.
When I was growing up in the 50s and the 60s, Cambodia was a very peaceful country. And we were sort of part of the middle class, but when my father passed away, when I was 9 years old, my mother struggled to bring us up. I was the youngest boy, and she worked very hard to send me to school and to high school, and we all were very lucky to have such a loving mother, and she told me, still, you know, in my head that no matter what happens, never give up hope. So that message sort of remains with me all my life. After the Khmer Rouge came to power in 1975, I was able to survive 1 year under the Khmer Rouge, and then I escaped to Thailand and to the United States. That because of my mother's wisdom of never give up hope, no matter what happens.
So what happened when the regime of Pol Pot came into power? You were an upper-middle-class family. Most of your family was killed. How did you survive? What happened to your family and to you?
Well, on April 17, 1975, the Khmer Rouge came to power, and they immediately turned the country upside down. Cambodia became suddenly a land of blood and tears. The Khmer Rouge would kill anybody who wore glasses, which was a sign of being educated. Anybody who had been to school, anybody who was in the government, merchants, businessmen, military, doctor, nurses, and so on and so forth. They said that there were only two kinds of people under the Khmer Rouge, those who had died and those who would die. And my mother told me to run away because I went to school, I wore glasses, I spoke French, I spoke English, and I worked for a relief organization, an American organization. I was supposed to be airlifted out of Cambodia by the U.S. Embassy, but I missed the last helicopter by 30 minutes. So I joined my mother, my sister, my brother, and their children. There were 16 of us, and we left Phnom Penh that day. Among the 16 who left together, I am the only survivor. They were all killed afterwards. So I was separated from them early on. It was not until 4 or 5 years later that I learned that they were killed.
How did you become separated from them, and how did you survive yourself?
Well, after my mother told me to go because my background would put myself in danger, but also would put everybody in jeopardy, because they killed the entire family, not just the person that they suspected of being the enemy of the revolution. She gave me her wedding ring, her scarf, and a sack of rice, and I rode a bicycle for 3 weeks using false excuses and fake passes, getting through the Mao's checkpoints. Finally, I was captured near the Thai border sometime in June 1975. They tied my arms behind my back, and they were going to kill me that night. But a truck driver whom I had met a few days before saved me. He told the Khmer Rouge that I was an innocent person, and that I was just traveling around looking for my family. Now, the same truck driver saved me the second time in September 75. I had an accident. I told them that I was a truck driver, so they put me behind the wheel, and I couldn't see because I had no glasses. I went off the road, and damaging a truck, which was a state property, carried death sentence under the Khmer Rouge. So they were going to kill me, but then the same truck driver saved me. He said that the accident, the damage was very minor, and it would take just a moment to fix it. So for about 1 year, I worked in Cambodia as a slave labor, working 18 hours a day. We were given 1 meal a day to eat. At night, when I went to sleep, I never knew if I would be alive the following day. When I woke up, I realized that I was still in Cambodia, still alive. I said I would make it to Thailand and to freedom. So as I said a moment ago, my mother's message of never give up hope kept on ringing in my ears. And finally, they sent me to pick up timber along the Thai border. And I jumped off the truck on February 13, 1976. I walked for 3 days, having nothing to eat or to drink. I fell in a booby trap. I was severely wounded. I arrived in Thailand completely exhausted. And in Thailand, I was jailed for illegal entry. But later on, I made contact with a friend of mine in Bangkok, and he came to bail me out, and I was transferred to a refugee camp.
Now, you grew up in a Buddhist culture, and I wondered whether the religious practice of Buddhism affected your experience of suffering and loss and survival.
Well, in a sense, yes, but it was not me, just me alone. It was the whole country, the whole society that was subjected to this kind of suffering. And we didn't know what happened, and nobody knew where the Khmer Rouge came from, and suddenly they turn us into slave laborers, where the only death penalty was the only correction issue. You made a mistake, you are dead. There is a principle of karma, KARMA. You know, you do good thing, you will have a better life in the future. If you did bad things in the previous life, you have to have some suffering. But when the whole country, the whole society, when 6-7 million people were going through that kind of thing, there is no way to explain it.
So you were in a refugee camp in Thailand. What happened next, and how did you end up coming to the United States?
In a refugee camp, there were about 3,000 people living there in an area the size of a soccer field. It was very hot, filthy, humid. Many suffered severe mental depression because they sat around all day feeling sorry about the past and worrying about the future. I thought I would do something to help them out, so I organized English classes. It was a win-win situation because many people were going to go to an English-speaking country, such as Australia, Canada, the UK, and the United States. So they were able to get some basic English before they leave the refugee camp. At the same time, they were able to take their minds off the sorrows and the worries. On June 4th, 1976, 1 month before the bicentennial, I arrived in Connecticut with $2 in my pocket, my mother's scarf, and an empty rice bag. I was sick, tired, and exhausted, but I was full of hope. I told myself that I must adapt in order to be adopted. I must adapt myself to America so that America would adopt me.
You were sponsored by a family? Is that how you got to Connecticut?
That's right. I was sponsored by a family in Wallingford, Connecticut, which is about 2 hours north of New York City. They used to live in Thailand, so they had some familiarity with Cambodia. They did go to Cambodia at one point to visit, and they were classmates of one of my colleagues at CARE, and they offered to take me in. I did not know anybody in the United States, not a single human being.
So how did your life go forward from there, and how did you eventually get involved in politics?
When I got there in 76, I wanted to be on my own feet, so I started to work right away. I picked apples in Connecticut. I ate a lot of apples, enough to last for a lifetime. And then I went to work for an ice cream store. I scooped ice cream. I cooked hamburgers. Then I decided to move to New York. I became a taxi driver in New York. I just did everything that came my way to the best of my ability. I finally got a scholarship to go to Columbia, where I did a Master of International Affairs. And went to work on Wall Street. Then I did a few other things until 1988, when there was a presidential election. When I arrived 12 years earlier in Connecticut in 1976, I was watching the conventions in my host family, and I did not understand what was going on. I saw all these people wearing funny hats, jumping up and down the chair, screaming, shouting, yelling. And my host family told me that this is a convention. These people are delegates. They're going to choose two nominees, and we're going to vote on the two nominees. And they turned to me. They said that, you know, Sichuan, if you wanted to understand this country, you should get involved. So my chance to get involved was in 1988. I was working in New York, and I already met my wife, Martha, who hailed from Pampa, Texas, in the Panhandle. And I decided to volunteer from the beginning. I was early enough to be exposed to the complete process of presidential election campaign. So when Bush got elected, he asked me to go and work for him at the White House. I was with him for 4 years, and when he left, I returned to the private sector. I should add that on Christmas Eve, 1983, Martha and I got married in Pampa, Texas. It was a very cold winter. Pampa was one of the coldest spots in the United States, and we decided to go to Santa Fe to spend our honeymoon. So Santa Fe and Taos have a very special place for us.
How did your experience shape your political views and the decisions you made about party politics?
After I arrived in the United States in 1976, I was just so sick of communists, of dictatorship, of those tyrants, and when Jimmy Carter was elected president in that year, and for 4 years I noticed that the United States seemed to be weakening its position worldwide, and I felt more related to the Republican ideas because I believe in the Reagan principle of a strong defense, of fighting communism, of increasing, improving the economy, and of providing individual freedom as a basic of our foundations, and that drew me more to the Republican politics than to the Democrat. So when I became a U.S. citizen, I registered to be a Republican.
What is Cambodia like now?
Cambodia is what I called a flawed democracy since 1993, with our support, the United Nations organized an election, and then they were won every 5 years. In 1993, there were less irregularities, less violence, but there are still a lot of problems, domestic issues like corruption, impunity, crimes, and so on and so forth. The country is a little bit more stable, but the degree of poverty is still striking, especially when you travel from the capital and the provincial cities. The United States has been a major benefactor in the garment industry, which we provide enormous quotas. If you go to one of the stores in the United States, chances that you will find something with a label made in Cambodia. That is because we provided such a strong support. The agricultural sector is improving quite a bit, but I think the second largest foreign currency earner is tourism. Yeah, you probably know about the Angkor Temple complex. Angkor Wat is now the world's largest religious monument, and most of the temples that were built in between the 9th and 15th centuries are still there. And it was a huge civilization during those centuries. It symbolized very much a major achievement of humankind, you know, in architecture, in building, in stone structure, and so on and so forth. So the number of tourists now is about 2 million people per year, and it keeps on increasing, and that provides a lot of foreign currency earnings to the country and to the service sector, you know, like hotels, restaurants, handicraft, villages, and so on and so forth.
Sichuan Siv is former ambassador to the United Nations. His memoir is called Golden Bones, and he will be in Santa Fe this Saturday, August 27th, at 5 o'clock at the Travel Bug bookstore on Paseo de Peralta, and we'll have copies of the book. We look forward to meeting you, and thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me on your program.
And before we go this morning, I want to remind people about the very special evening with Russ Baker, award-winning investigative journalist, author of the book Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. He's editor of the news website whowhatwhy.com, and he will be in Santa Fe doing a benefit for KSFR this Saturday, the 27th of August, at 7 in the evening at the Armory for the Arts. For information and reservations, please call 428-1379. Yours truly will be moderating the question and answer and introducing Russ Baker. It should be a great night. Hope to see you there.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.